Singing for the Bishop. "Can I have my jacket, Gran?" Nina asks. Nina is my daughter. Her hair sticks up from her head in blondie spikes, but there's no point in telling her to brush it. There's no point in telling her anything these days. My mother looks confused. "I haven't seen it." "You're wearing it." "Am I?" "It doesn't matter." Nina is exasperated. She lifts her school bag off the hook at the end of the stairs and heads for the door. "Wait, Nina, it's raining. She'll give it back to you," I say. "I'll be late." The door slams and she's gone. My mother and I look at each other while the air in the house settles. I make a pot of tea and sit at the table to pour it out. My mother hunches into Nina's jacket. The sad thing is that it fits her. She used to be a big woman. "I'll be late too," she says mournfully, sipping her tea. "For what?" "Practice." Her hands tremble when she puts the mug down. I move it in from the edge of the table before it falls. "The bishop is coming. We're going to sing for him." She begins to hum an old tune, a hymn I grew up with but have long forgotten. Her voice is thin and shaky like her, but the notes are true. She smiles at me shyly. "I could have been a singer, you know." My mother is confused about a lot of things. She thinks she is a girl again, in school. She chats away to Nina with such conviction that Nina chats right back to her. If I listen closely, I can pick up clues about what either of them is thinking. My mother is unclear about who I am, although she seems to like me well enough. "How's your mother?" she asked me the other day, and I had to leave the room because she doesn't like it when people get upset. "Get over it," Nina would say. It's her latest phrase. Nina babysits for the neighbours, and she used her money to buy herself a mobile phone for Christmas. "I had to get myself something," she said, as if her best chance of a present, any present, was to buy one herself. I bit my lip on the months of storing small things away, the baby pink sweater that was too small by the time she got it, the CD that had vanished from the charts in late November. You may have gathered that I don't know my daughter very well. I blame that phone as much as anything else. For one thing, I never know where she is anymore. "I have my phone," she says when I ask her where she's going. She could be anywhere. When I was growing up, you could always guess what was going on in a person's life by how jumpy they were when the phone rang out in the hall, by how long they were willing to spend shivering under the stairs talking to someone. I wish I could get as close as a telephone to any of my daughter's friends. I'd learn to recognize their voices. I'd watch her reaction to their names. I'd try to read her life that way. She's only 13, and I'm not ready to lose her yet. I'm not ready to lose my mother either, but that's not going to change anything. She stops singing when Billy comes into the room. "They won't join in," she scowls in my direction, "and we've got to get it right." "Won't they?" Billy laughs. "They're an uncooperative lot, all right. What'll we do with them?" I wish he wouldn't humour her like that. I think we should do what we can to keep her anchored in reality. But my mother loves Billy, and he likes her. So I've little to complain about when he offers to sit with her so that I can take the car and drive over to the square before we run out of everything. "Can I come with you?" she asks, like a child. "Not this time." If I don't get some time to myself, I'll scream. My mother loves the square. She hasn't lost that sense of possibility that I remember feeling when it was first built. It seemed foreign somehow, with its terraces spread under the artificial warmth of that pyramid of glass, and the sounds of music and falling water and all those brightly dressed people. There are shops there that you'd find in London, or even Paris, but it's not new to me anymore. It's just where I shop. Normally I'd walk. I like crossing the park and the footbridge, and it can be hard enough to find parking close to the doors. But I've a lot to get, and with Billy home I may as well use the car. I park in the multi-story and try to remember what it was like when we first moved here, when there was more open space, before the car park and the civic offices. when my mother was still my mother. We used to take Nina over to the cinema every weekend. The Little Mermaid reminded my mother of her own drowned valley, and she told Nina all about it. But Nina was too young to understand the stories I grew up on. My mother's people lived on the side of a hill not far from here until the valley was flooded to make the reservoir, drowning the land in a tide of progress, like the roads now and the houses. She was Nina's age then. The day the water came, the neighbors had to go and take one man out of his house by force. Even while it was happening, he couldn't believe that someone would deliberately cause water to rise in his kitchen. He thought he could stop it, but there are some things you can't reverse. For weeks afterwards, that man's bed bobbed around on the surface of the water like a boat. No one could bear to look at it. The new lake was treacherous, neither one thing nor the other. First, two local boys drowned in a place where there should have been air. Then the fish began to die. My grandfather's house was above the waterline, but he said the place was out of luck and it was time to leave. Years later, when Billy and I moved out here, we brought my mother with us. She said the line of hills behind our house felt like home. To me, it seemed like the edge of something. But before long, the city caught up with us and overtook us, throwing the square up like an island of color in the middle of all that progress. Today, I can't get her out of my mind. The way she asked to come with me, and I told her no, it would have been easier to bring her. When I get back with the shopping, I bring her out for a walk to make up for leaving her behind. We turn our backs on the road and look out from the small hill of the park with its tufty grass and its granite slabs to the blue of the mountains, scored by a ribbon of silver in the sunlight. I tuck my arm in hers and remind myself that things can only be what they are, and that nothing lasts forever. Later, when we were in bed, Billy brings up the subject of a nursing home. It's not the first time. While he's talking, our door swings open the way it used to when Nina was little, but it's my mother who stands uncertainly in the dark. I get up to bring her back to bed. She's crying, so I stay with her and smooth her hair until she falls asleep. Back in my own bed, I dream about the valley, the water, and the lost boys. I dream that my aching breasts leak milk onto the sheets, but when I wake, they are bone dry, and it's my mother's sheets that need changing. Over breakfast, she complains about the girls in her class who talk through singing practice. "They don't understand how important it is," she says, "about the bishop." She's singing again when I go for a shower. When I come back downstairs, the singing has stopped and I can't find my mother anywhere. Billy's reading the paper in bed. He hasn't seen her for a while. Nina is listening to music in her room. When I knock on her door, she waits just long enough to let me know what she thinks about interruptions in general and me in particular before she opens it. "Where's Gran?" "She's in the kitchen." "No, she's not." Nina picks at her nails and looks sullen. "Well, how am I supposed to know where she is?" I want to kill her. Billy gets dressed while I go to the door and look up and down the street. There's no sign of her. I try to remember what she was wearing while I ring the neighbors to know if they have seen her. No one has. Billy says that he will drive round and look for her. Mary from next door offers to stay in the house in case she comes back, while Nina and I go to look in the park. I'm suddenly filled with dread that she's out there on the motorway, dodging cars in her faded purple dressing gown. I run out onto the bridge to look, but there's no sign of her. The wind whips through the mesh, and the cars speed by underneath, indifferent, pulling the city behind them. "Take it easy, Ma." Nina's calm voice surprises me. "Maybe she's over there." She points to the red and blue mass of the square, its cone of glass. I follow her down the ramp and across the car park because I don't know what else to do. The doors slide open and the music and the Saturday crowds wash over and around us. The suited women at the service desk are kind but busy. They haven't seen my mother, but they look out for her. Then I see her. She's standing at the entrance to Bewley's, as if she's waiting for someone to tell her where to sit. She looks frail but unremarkable in Nina's jacket. I try to keep my voice even when I say, "There you are, Ma." "About time." She's cross. "I've been waiting ages." "Is that the curate?" She points at Nina. "I'm ready to sing, if you like." There's an empty table on the terrace. "Sit here and we'll get you a nice cup of tea," I say. Her hands are ice cold and her face is grey, and I don't want to chance walking her home. Nina uses her phone to ring Billy and tell him where we are. Then she goes off to get a tray, a pot of tea, 3 cups. She's a different kind of stranger now, my daughter. Capable. My mother complains that no one turned up for choir practice. "I waited for ages and ages," she says. "They're a shower of wasters, the lot of them. They don't care about the bishop." "Never mind," I tell her. "But we have to practice." She closes her eyes and starts to sing. Nina puts the tray down and looks around, her eyes narrowed. For once, I feel sorry for her. But then I hear her say, in tones fiercer than any she's ever used to me, "What are you looking at?" A woman in a camel hair coat at the next table shuts her mouth and looks away. Nina slides into the seat beside my mother and pours the tea. She looks around defiantly, daring anyone else to comment. People below us stop and look to see where the wavering voice is coming from. Da di da da. Before I know that I'm going to do it, I take my mother's hand and hum along with her. Nina shifts in her seat. "Don't." When I begin to sing, my voice is clearer and louder than my mother's. If she wants a choir, she can have one. Nina could walk away, but she doesn't. She's embarrassed, but she puts up with us. When Billy arrives, my mother and I are singing our song at the tops of our voices, above the sound of clattering cups, music, and running water, over the disapproval of the shoppers. It's a rousing song, not for the faint-hearted. Mother of Christ, star of the sea, we call to the glass ceiling, to anyone who will listen. Pray for the wanderer, pray